Our second case this morning is 2021-1432, the State of Ohio versus Titus Bailey for the appellant. Mr. Cummings?
Yes, thank you. Madam Chief Justice, good morning. Phil Cummings for the State of Ohio from Hamilton County. The prior argument, which I just listened to, is going to inform my presentation this morning, and I was very happy to hear this unfold. I'm not going to argue this case as a merger issue case. This really is about the plain error doctrine and the preservation of the plain error doctrine. I think the court below here misapplied it. And they misapplied the plain error doctrine because they found plain error under circumstances where it wasn't error at all, let alone plain error. And I think this issue is important, and I think it's worth this court's time and attention because, as Justice Moyer cautioned years ago, it's very important to preserve the doctrine of plain error because it serves a very valid interest. It balances encouraging litigants at trial to seek a fair adjudication at the time so that errors can be caught and addressed in a timely manner. It balances that need with also the obvious need to correct terrible miscarriages of justice when appropriate. And I think what we're seeing with a lot of these merger cases is a misapplication of what the plain error doctrine is. And I think courts are finding plain error under situations where it's not plain at all. I think when you look at and you see what does plain error mean, it's supposed to be obvious. It's supposed to be something that it's clear. It really reasonably cannot be contested.
Counselor, do you think the kidnapping and rape being separate offenses, do you think it could ever be subject to a plain error analysis?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I think, like in this case, for example, if Mr. Bailey had raped the victim here in a standstill rape,
on the spot,
and then the trial court sentenced separately, I think that would be a clear plain error. And I think we most people could agree with that. It could be called out and it could be corrected as such.
But we don't have the benefit of analysis of saying if the defendant takes the victim 5 feet away or 10 feet away or one block away or around the corner from the bushes. We don't have that clear demarcation. I guess obviously that supports your argument that then error can't be plain. It's a matter of, it's a subjective view. Trial court versus appellate court, what happened here. But does there come some point where the movement is far enough? I mean, in this case, and I don't remember the exact distance, I know that the victim was taken and secreted in a garage. I don't know how far that was from where she was standing, if it was, you know, around a pillar, mm-hmm. having walked substantial way.
Yes.
But it seems like you're saying anything other than immediate assault or rape at the point, the spot of where the victim is, anything other than that can't be plain error.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
I think, as is so often true in these types of merger cases, any good attorney with their salt can cite, discuss, and distinguish precedential cases and then pronounce a conclusion and say that's compelled by the facts or it's obvious from the facts that this was plainly evident. And that's not really the case at all many times. A lot of these issues are just go to good lawyering. And that's why you have a lot of differing results in cases like this. And this court's acknowledged that many times. In Johnson, the court said, look, some of these cases are going to be difficult to analyze. And you're going to have similar scenarios decided differently because it is a very subjective
analysis. So if the defendant had preserved this error and the appellate court found the same, then you likely would not be here. You're here because you're saying this is a clear assault on the plain error doctrine?
Absolutely. I think if he'd raised this at trial, it could have been addressed there. The Court of Appeals could have done a de novo review, which is essentially what it did anyway. But for the court, under the paradigm of this case, for the court to find and call what happened here plain error is absurd. It's not plain error.
So then why isn't this just error correction on our part?
Well, this, I think it's important for this court to define exactly how the plain error doctrine needs to be applied in cases like this. And these subjective close call type cases should not be very just easily and readily labeled as plain error.
Do you think this is a subjective close call? Would you call this a close call?
No, not at all. But I think it represents... Well, in a sense, it is. I mean, this is the kind of case. What I mean is, this Bailey case is the kind of case where, given the judge and given the attorneys, it could have gone either way. I could stand here right now and make a great case, like the Court of Appeals below did, for explaining why this merges. And I think the court below presented that case.
Using all the rationale and analysis of the law about what it takes to merge, you can get all that right, but then when you apply it to the facts of the case, that's where the problem, you know, is, you know, it's obvious. And are you saying that's subjective with the judge?
No, what I'm saying is that when you have a case that presents something that can clearly, that it can go either way, depending upon how the person views it, how the judge views it, how the reviewing court views it. Some cases are just no-brainers. They're, you know, like if you just fall down and rape somebody, that's obviously going to merge. If you take somebody five states away and hold them for 20 days or whatever, that's obviously not going to merge. A lot of these cases, most of them are in this vague middle area, and when a trial judge makes a decision, it's not objected to at trial when it could have been corrected or at least addressed, then we're not in... What we're into there is forfeited error analysis, like in the Rogers case. This could have been corrected. It could have been objected to. It wasn't. So now we're under the Rogers precedent, which this court has said that when you have an allied offense issue and you don't raise it, you don't object, you go to a plain error analysis. So that's where we are here. We're not in a de novo posture. We're in a plain error analysis, and that's very clear. Under plain error, you have to find error, and it has to be plain. And in cases like these, where any of us could argue both sides of it, it's absurd to call that plain and then make a judgment on that.
Counsel, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Under the facts of this case, hypothetically, if the victim was taken as far as she was in this case, and let's say the defendant decided to abandon what he intended to do, couldn't you have charged kidnapping separately? You could stand on its own 2 feet.
Absolutely. So. She tried to get away. I think she almost did. He grabbed her again. But, yeah, if she'd gotten away.
And oftentimes, if you ask the state when they charge corresponding rape and kidnapping, and you say, what is the factual basis of the kidnapping? They may say, well, when the person was in the act of rape, they were restraining them of their liberty. Would you agree in a situation like that, those two counts would merge?
Yes. Okay. That's what I mean. And I think there, if you'd had separate sentences, that would be a plain error analysis. It should be called out and corrected. Okay. That's not what we have here. And I think it's very important for this court to preserve the plain error doctrine. And let's call these cases what they are. This wasn't a plain error. And I think it certainly does not present any court with a miscarriage of justice that demands redress. I think if you ask any person in this case, if they had been treated like this victim was, yanked by the arm and carried some, you know, down a downtown street into a deserted garage, talk about Nightmare on Elm Street, that's it. And that is a harm that she suffered psychologically, to her, irrespective of whatever happens when she gets to the garage, which, you know, in her mind could have been murder. She didn't know what she was facing. So this is something...
So, counsel, we have, in this case, he dragged her a block away, right?
About, yes.
Yeah, okay, but there's no sufficient... We've never come up with a definition of sufficient movement separate and apart from the continuous act to commit a rape. Would you agree with that? That's a complicating factor.
Very much so, because it's very fact-intensive.
Okay, so what do we do about that? I mean, here he dragged her a block, and as you mentioned, she didn't know what was going to happen. He could have abandoned it at that point. That's kidnapping. How would you define or characterize what's necessary to have a standalone kidnapping?
I would dare to give that a specific definition. I think these cases, by their nature, are not, they're not, they don't lend themselves
to right-line
rules.
So they're all fact-specific. They're all fact-specific.
Absolutely. Let me give you an example. If I take some poor victim just from here to there, just so that we're hidden behind that, and that gives me cover to commit some type of offense, that's a very short movement. But yet the animus is to conceal my identity. The animus is to avoid detection. The reason for doing
that. The animus is to facilitate the rape.
Absolutely. But his movement of her facilitated the rape, but it also caused an identifiable separate harm. I don't think anybody would tell you under these circumstances that they didn't think this poor lady suffered a terrible, grievous psychological and mental harm by what happened to her. I think the miscarriage of justice here would be to discount that and to say it's plain error, obviously plain error, that you know these are sentenced separately. That's the miscarriage here.
Shouldn't the test, counsel, be whether the two charges can stand on their own two legs and be prosecuted just like this could have been prosecuted as a kidnapping had even if the rape had not occurred, even though
that's true. In this case, you're absolutely right. And as often is the case, if these people can escape before the rape happens, you can still you get the defendant for the kidnapping. So I think if you look at animus or you look at the secretive nature of the confinement and where they ducked into the garage, for a lot of different reasons, in this particular case, I could make a very good argument that these do not merge. I think that that's the whole point here. When a case lends itself to differing, you know, arguments and interpretations by good lawyers, it makes for difficult analysis, but it doesn't make for plain error. It makes for, you know, difficult cases, but it doesn't mean that the court committed plain error by making the call it did. And I think that if this court wants to preserve the faith of the public in the judicial system, I would distance itself from endorsing the decision below and, you know, minimizing what that woman suffered. And actually, I think it was mentioned in the decision somewhere that she was actually fortunate that, you know, the guy picked a garage that had a video surveillance system, so, you know, he could be caught the next day. That's tone deaf to me. That's shocking. If you're citing that type of a fact to justify, I don't think this is the kind of case that warrants reversal on a merger issue like this. I can reserve my time unless the court has any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Hill.
Madam Chief Justice, excuse me.
I'm so sorry.
Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, Mr. Cummings, may it please the court. The state has kind of framed this case as almost a subjective factual dispute, a close call, as they put it. They're correct that in cases such as these, the facts do matter, but we would submit that the facts here really aren't at issue, and this isn't really a close call. This is ultimately a legal dispute. And the legal dispute is what is the legal significance of the facts at issue here? And
is that really what we're deciding here, or are we deciding whether an appellate court can view this merger scenario as plain error?
Well, I think the court already decided that in Underwood, essentially. That was the case where there was a guilty plea, where there were two theft offenses under one section, and then there were two lesser theft offenses under another section, but they only concerned two discrete acts. And even though the trial court and the counsel in that case acquiesced to concurrent, albeit separate, sentences for those offenses, the This court looked at that and said, no, you can't do that.
How is that the same when, in this scenario, we have appellate court decisions that have less movement than this be declared two separate offenses, kidnapping, rape, and in some instances where there may be just as much movement or more that's declared, you know, allied offenses? In other words, it is a standard that is not precisely definable. More than moving the victim more than 2 feet away constitutes both kidnapping and a separate offense.
Right, and I think in a case where it's a standstill rape, I think everyone's in agreement that we would be talking about cases that, or two offenses that should absolutely merge. And then I think there was the example that Mr. Cummings cited where you took the victim, you know, 5 states away, held him for 20 days. That's obvious. The fact of the matter is, though, there are ample cases, and Logan being the big one, where we basically had the exact same set of facts here, and the court basically said no separate and identifiable harm. These clearly merge.
But were they identical facts to this case?
Essentially, I mean, you had a situation where the defendant found the victim on the street, took them an equidistant distance away, down an alleyway, around the corner, down a set of stairs, basically more or less the one city block that's at issue here, arguably held the victim in a more concealed location, held them at knife point, and then in both cases you're talking about a situation where the victim was immediately released. So what you need to look at here is the independent legal significance of the facts, and the questions are, in that regard, are you talking about separate and identifiable harms, and you're talking about separate animuses? And in this case, the answer to both of those questions is no. The facts here are really not in dispute. Mr. Bailey was clear about what his intentions were from the outset. He found this poor woman and her companions on the street, tried to rob them. When he could find nothing of value from Ms. Rapold, he said, well, you're going to sexually gratify me.
All right. You're saying that there was no separate and identifiable harm to this victim?
Relative to the kidnapping and the rape, that's the position we've taken, yes.
Okay. But you would agree, had he done everything to her, grabbed her forcibly, dragged her down the street, gone to an abandoned, and at that point stopped, okay, and decided, you know, for, you know, maybe he thinks somebody's coming or whatever, that's kidnapping, right?
I would argue it's abduction.
Still a separate crime.
Right.
Right, but then you wouldn't have the rape. It's a different situation. And here, what you're talking about, the harm that the state has identified is essentially a psychic injury, but as Logan...
You don't think that she would have had psychic injury even if the rape hadn't occurred?
I believe she would have had psychic injury had the rape occurred, but she wouldn't...
No.
Or had the rape not occurred. But
right, she would have had a separate and identifiable harm.
But you also wouldn't be talking about a rape, because the rape would have never happened.
Well, the rape might not have happened, but his intent on dragging her, you know, down was to rape her, and
right.
But for the intervention of maybe footsteps or something like that, you know, he runs off.
Right.
Okay, you think that's just mere abduction, even though he was intending to rape this victim?
I believe it was the fact of the rape, and it was the fact of the rape that the state relied upon at trial to actually prove up that element of the kidnapping. Without the rape having actually occurred, we would be talking about an abduction based on the elements of kidnapping versus abduction. It's a position we've taken consistently throughout this entire process. But getting back to the notion of the plain error doctrine, we're talking about a situation here where the court was within its rights to review.
Why wouldn't this be a kidnapping?
Why wouldn't it?
Right. It's a person who, by force, removes another mm-hmm. person from a place where they're found, restrains their liberty, and in doing so, they create a substantial risk of physical harm. That's kidnapping.
It was the facilitation of a felony section that he was charged under, not significant physical harm. I might have meant A1.
But he could have been charged under the other one, too. I mean, it wouldn't matter. I mean, there's serious risk of physical harm, dragging someone from a homeless encampment across the street, across
over a major highway into a parking garage, holding them in the parking garage, that's clearly a kidnapping.
Okay, but the fact of the matter is then he still wouldn't have been charged with the rape. And what we're talking about here is a situation where he was charged under...
If he hadn't committed the rape, he wouldn't be charged with it. But here he committed two different things.
That's what the hypothetical was, right?
But it says, for any of the following purposes, to facilitate the commission of any felony or flight thereafter.
Right.
You're saying that the animus for the kidnapping was the rape, and whereas regardless of what the animus was, if he dragged her off and not done the rape, it would have been abduction.
Right. This is why we've taken the position that there was plain error here, is because he was clearly, I mean, there was no factual dispute here. He took the victim in this case across the street with the express purpose of committing the rape. He articulated that verbally.
If the rape didn't happen, you say it would be abduction. Why? If he moved someone and restrained them of their liberty and took them somewhere with the intent to commit a sexual motivation, that would be kidnapping. It would not be motivation just because he didn't complete the act.
That's true. So, still, the court did properly apply the rough factors here in finding that there was plain error. I mean, there was no, the bottom line is this: was there a separate animus? No.
So, under that standard, someone could take someone 200 miles if their only purpose was to rape them.
Well, no, that's not true.
Why not?
Well, what I'm saying
here, what you said, there's no separate animus because the reason they did this was to rape. Let me finish. So, because the reason to do this was to rape them. So,
sure.
Why wouldn't any time someone takes someone somewhere with their only reason doing it to rape them, there be no separate animus under your theory?
Well, I think there have been cases where, in the state side of the number of these, where there was a kidnapping and then there was a rape and then there was also a murder. Those were the number of the cases, like the Prince case that the state pointed to in their brief. Here, there really was only one animus. Mr. Bailey didn't take the victim to this garage strictly for the purpose of kidnapping her and raping her, only for the purpose of raping her.
So what if instead of taking him, she blocks, he had taken her 10 miles because that was the most secluded spot he could find?
Well, I don't think the distance matters for purpose of animus. It matters only for purpose of separate and identifiable harms.
Well, would the same analysis apply whether it's 3 blocks or 10 miles?
Does the same analysis apply? But yes, but what the courts have to do, what the reviewing court has to do, is look for independent legal significance.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand your theory, and I guess the First District's theory is that because he did all this to facilitate a kidnapping, there was no separate animus, so...
What's one prong of the rough analysis?
Okay, can I finish, please?
Yes.
So, what's the line here? I mean, like if he had taken her to Sharonville, would that be just a rape?
We really have to depend on what if there was another animus here, and we're talking about the case where
under my hypothetical, the only reason he drove her there was that was the most convenient place for him to commit his rape.
Well, no, that would mean there was no separate animus, but there could still be a separate and identifiable harm.
But then why wouldn't there be a separate identifiable harm here?
There was no harm identified that was separate from the commission of the rape.
So if he drove her to Sharonville and didn't do anything to her, didn't hurt her in any other way, separate from raping her, that would simply be a rape?
Under those circumstances, it could be, yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to follow up on that question. What's the distance? I mean, when does the animus change? There's a parking garage up on Fifth Street there. If he had dragged her, same animus, up to Fifth Street, are you saying no merger?
It would really be fact-specific.
Everything's the same, except the distance. Fifth Street garage instead of the third street.
Two additional blocks.
Yeah.
I think what I would say here is that it's not necessarily the distance that matters, it's the legal significance of the distance. It's whether that distance creates, you know, a substantial additional risk of harm, or if it evinces some other intent on his part other than commission of the underlying offense, and that's what this court determined in Logan.
Well, the Fifth Street garage is closed and the Third Street garage is open, people are there, so he goes Fifth Street. What if he goes, there's a garage at Eighth Street? Well, and all the others are business active, and the 8th Street garage is abandoned.
Right. And again, I would go back to the same principle. Is there anything that evinces other intent than the commission of the underlying offense? That's the analysis that the court had to engage in. That was what the First District was obligated to engage in. They looked at the record. They saw a record that didn't show any other animus on Mr. Bailey's part other than the commission of the rape, and the state, you know, proceeded under the theory that the kidnapping was a kidnapping by virtue of the rape. They didn't identify any additional harm caused by Mr. Bailey's conduct.
Did he threaten to kill her if she left the garage or infected him with sexually transmitted disease?
Correct. He articulated that there was some kind of a simple assault that succeeded the commission of the rape.
A simple assault? He repeatedly struck her in the face and threatened to kill her if she left the garage.
And what I say simple assault, I mean the definition, the misdemeanor assault. I'm not downplaying what happened to Ms. Rapold here. I think everyone's on the same page.
Okay, so he says, I've confined you, and you'd better stay confined. That's what the message is to her at that point. And she's terrified.
Right.
And that he's going to be watching her leave the garage or, you know, do whatever to secure help.
He immediately extricated himself from the situation, as did the defendant in Logan. It's pretty much factually indistinct.
Well, how did she know that? How did she know he wasn't around the corner watching what she was going to do?
Well, the analysis here pertains to objectively what his conduct was, and his conduct in this case is that he left the building right afterwards.
But you said that there's no separate identifiable harm that would precipitate, which would be necessary to precipitate a kidnapping separate from a rape.
Well, look, Your Honor, Mr. Bailey does not cut the most sympathetic figure here. I mean, what he did was absolutely terrible, and I'm not here to downplay what happened to the victim in this case. It was absolutely egregious what he did to her, and she suffered a major psychic injury as a result of this. My point is here that, you know, the state really hasn't identified a separate psychic injury relative to the kidnapping and the rape here. There's no way that you can demarcate that.
Let me ask you this. Did he try to rob her first?
He did try and rob her first. That
and, then he drags her into the garage.
Sure.
Wouldn't that make you pretty fearful?
I would think
that you might get killed.
I would think when you see this violent man dispatch your two or three or whatever it was friends with sucker punches and try and rob them, I think any way you cut it, Mr. Bailey cuts a terrifying figure.
No, but I'm asking something different. You're talking about the animus.
Sure.
And her import, okay?
Sure.
That's what we're looking at.
Sure.
If she sees her friends beaten and he's dragging her to the garage,
sure.
He does say the word nut, I agree, somewhere along the way. We don't know when. But he says that. Isn't she fearful about being both beaten, murdered, and raped?
But couldn't that potentially be the case if he, as the state suggests, just dragged her behind the bushes? I mean, no matter what he did in that regard, you never know what this guy's going to do. As the trial judge pointed out, this guy is kind of an animal. He's a terrible human being if you believe he did everything that he did.
Counsel, let me go back to elements. What would be the animus involved for kidnap?
Well, obviously, there's, in many cases, are you talking about kidnapping generally?
Just generally.
Generally, there is the animus of the commission of the underlying offense. Some people are just sadists, and they want to restrain people for the purpose of restraining.
But for the state to prove the offense of kidnapping, what would the state have to prove?
Well, under this section, they would have to prove the facilitation of an underlying offense.
No, for kidnapping in the purest form of if Mr. Bailey here had just been charged with kidnapping.
You just have to look at the elements of the offense, the movement, the restraint on liberty, and that. But typically there's another purpose. That's to either visit significant physical harm on another or to commit some other offense.
So if he had taken her to the garage, moved her to this purpose, for and said what he wanted to do and, of course, did not do anything. I think earlier you conceded that that would still be a kidnap.
If there was extraneous evidence to indicate intent to commit another offense or to facilitate flight thereafter, yes.
Okay.
Counsel, you've been asked a lot of questions about where's the line, how much distance, where to make it two separate crimes. Does that even matter when we're talking about separate animus? And I think that goes to the root of why there's so much confusion, because no one really knows. Animus is not a word that's used in common vernacular, so it means motivation.
Right.
In this case, his motivation, the ultimate motivation may have been the rape, but he was moving the person so he would not be observed in order to commit the separate crime. That's the separate animus.
I don't agree with that. I mean, I think it's the facilitation of the underlying offense with the intent of perpetuating the rape. It was part and parcel, inextricably linked to the commission of the rape. He didn't feel, as the state suggested, that he could simply have his way with her in the bushes on 2nd Street in Cincinnati, Ohio. He needed to move her for the purpose of committing the rape.
Right, but you conceded before if he moved her with the intent to commit a sexual crime and then for whatever reason abandoned that or couldn't do it, it would be a kidnapping that could be prosecuted by
the state. But the result would be the same. You'd have one offense. You'd just have the kidnapping. You would not have the rape.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief, one follow-up question.
All right.
From the standpoint of allied offenses, what briefly is the difference between import and harm?
Well, import concerns either harm or separate victims. In this case, we're only talking about the harm because there was only one victim in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you've saved almost 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two quick thoughts. It is true that he mentioned the word nut, but I think it's important to point out that he shouldn't get credit for just ending up doing what he told her he was going to do. What a swell fellow. That's irrelevant. This case really isn't the kind of case to draw bright lines about allied offense law. This case is perfectly set up, though, for this court to weigh in on the plain error doctrine, to preserve it, to defend it, and by doing so, you're also going to encourage litigants at the trial level to be more vigilant and make sure they're objecting and they're bringing this to the attention of the trial court when it should be brought. So I think it serves a dual purpose here if this court confines an analysis to the plain error doctrine and resists the temptation to go down the rabbit hole of analysis of allied offenses, because I really don't think it's required for resolution of this appeal. I think really it just has to be said, this is not a plain error case, it's a forfeited error case. And I think that's the point that needs to be driven home. Unless the court has any other questions, I have nothing more.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, we call a recess.
All rise.